Robert Badgerow is the first person in Canada to be tried four times for the same first-degree murder. The Hamilton Spectator has told the story from the very beginning. I'm David Crosby, and this is part two of Covering Diane, a Spectator serial podcast about nearly four decades of our coverage of one murder. By the time Robert Badgerow stood trial the first time in January 2001, 20 years had passed since Diane Rowendowitz was raped and murdered while trying to make the 15-minute walk home from a Stony Creek bar. The trial was held at Hamilton's John Sapinka Courthouse. The community was abuzz about the case and eager for details. People remembered the Ravine Rapist Task Force and the plea by police for the public's help in identifying the man who made the anonymous 911 call about Diane's body in the creek.
This the police?
Yes.
I got information on how that girl was killed in Barton Lake.
Barbara Brown was the Spec's court reporter then. She covered all the big trials, and the Badgerow trial was one of the biggest.
Yes, I would have to say that the case of Robert Badgerow was probably one of four or five major trials that really stood out over a career in covering courts of 25 years. You know, I covered Bernardo, and that was obviously a big trial, and then I had another trial that I covered for a long time about the abduction and murder of a school teacher that also stands out. But Robert Badgerow, you know, the thing that makes it so interesting in a way was how long it dragged out. I mean, it was 17 years from the time of the murder of Diane to his arrest by the Ravine Rapist Task Force.
As the evidence unfolded in the courtroom, it became clear that despite a DNA match between Badgerow and the semen found inside Diane, this case hinged on circumstantial evidence. Badgerow admitted it was his DNA and claimed he had unprotected consensual sex with Diane in his car outside the bar that night. But he insisted someone else killed her after she left him to walk home. Brown and Susan Claremont, the Spec columnist who inherited the case after Brown retired, each point to a private conversation Badgerow had with his brother-in-law, Randy Kovacic, as a brilliant summary of the complex investigation. The chat took place after the Ravine Rapist Task Force asked for help identifying the man who made the critical 911 call to police just after Diane's murder. Badgerow confided to Kovacic, a Hamilton police officer, that he'd once had sex with a stranger outside a Stony Creek bar. And wouldn't that be a terrible coincidence if she was the woman who was murdered? If that was the case, answered Kovacic, you're the unluckiest guy in the world.
And you've just laid out there, Barb, so many of the most interesting points of this entire case. The various branches of the stories that are all intertwined, and that quote by Randy Kovacic, the, you know, unluckiest guy in the world quote, which I think just sums up this whole case so perfectly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's winds up being the position of the defense at trial, is that, you know, basically their client, Robert Badgerow, is just the unluckiest guy in the world.
Yeah, and which is a crazy, unrealistic defense.
Ridiculously unrealistic. I mean, the chances of Robert Badgerow having consensual sex with a stranger, with a woman who then is murdered by someone else on her walk home, and then that 911 call just happens to come from, or appears to have come from, a phone booth meters away from where Robert Badgerow is working his shift at DeFasco. I mean, it just, you know, it's mathematically impossible for all of that to come together.
Yeah. This was not a case, there were no eyewitnesses to the murder of Diane Rowendowitz. It was a circumstantial case, and sometimes juries feel unsure about circumstantial cases. They don't believe that, you know, they're as strong as an eyewitness case. But when you put together all of the circumstantial evidence, and there's so much of it, and you put it together in a cohesive fashion, and you look at it, you have to come to the conclusion that this man is guilty.
The trial lasted 54 days. Brown was there for all of it.
Back in those days, newspapers had more resources, and I covered my beat very thoroughly. I covered all of the pretrial motions, the voir dires. I wanted to be there to hear why evidence was being excluded. And murder trials were a priority.
One of the witnesses subpoenaed by the Crown to testify was journalist Hank Danishevsky. It is rare in Canada for journalists to be subpoenaed to testify. Even rarer for one to be called to testify at a first-degree murder trial. 2 decades earlier, Danishevsky was a summer intern at The Spectator, who happened to be working the weekend Diane was murdered. He went to the home of Diane's parents to do his very first pickup. A pickup is one of the toughest assignments for any reporter, knocking on the door of a family that has just lost a loved one, asking for an interview, and picking up a photo of the deceased. By the time he was called as a witness, Danishevsky was a seasoned reporter with the London Free Press.
Then I get this call out of the blue from the Hamilton police saying, we're going to want you to be a witness in this trial of Robert Badgerow for this murder. And of course, I was shocked that this would come up so many years later. And as a journalist, especially, it's sort of uncomfortable because you never expect to be part of the story, might be a very small part of the story, but still, suddenly I was in there, and it was just kind of a weird, novel experience to be in this. So I went through this process of, what ended up being 4 trials and doing my little bit. And it was kind of frustrating, too, is because I was essentially a witness for the prosecution. I was only told the bare minimum what was going on. I wasn't allowed to sit through the trial. So I had this very narrow perspective as to what was going on.
Danishevsky was trying his best to recall details from one brief assignment 20 years earlier.
I had this cross-examination. Of course, my memory wasn't great. I mean, there were certain key details I remembered, other things that, I'd forgotten or just were sort of muddled up. I remember his first question was, do you have any notes from that time? And I thought, well, of course not, that was 20 years ago. Why would I keep notes for 20 years, right? I mean, the standard practice is about 6 months, right? And he sort of, sniffed away as if you're not a very good journalist if you haven't kept your notes for 20 years or something like that. So it just the whole process was kind of intimidating.
It was only later, after he was finished on the stand, that Danishevsky understood why he was called to testify. The defense was suggesting that the summer intern had insider information about the crime scene. That somehow, Danishevsky knew details of Diane's murder that he never put in his story, yet spread amongst people in the community. And that one of those people was the anonymous man who called 911 and described Diane's death scene. The defense was suggesting that the call wasn't made by Badgerow at all.
The defense's position was that the police had told me as a reporter details, all sorts of details that for some unknown reason I did not include in the story, but subsequent to that, I somehow went out and sort of blabbed all of these details on the streets of Hamilton, and I'm still, I guess they were grasping at straws, but I still found it, annoying that I was being pulled into this because of this rather wild theory that the defense had concocted.
When the jury began its deliberations on a verdict, the Rowendowitz family, Badgerow, and the city waited with bated breath for the outcome. It was one of the longest waits in Hamilton trial history, 8 days.
That was probably one of the most emotional verdicts that I've ever covered. That is a standout in terms of verdicts. It had been a long trial. What I remember was the verdict, the captain of the jury, the president of the jury standing up, delivering the verdict, and then all of a sudden, Cheryl Badgerow, Robert Badgerow's wife, starts wailing and sobbing. And it's a pretty packed courtroom. So, the room is electric with emotions. And then you hear this lone voice of this woman who's wailing because she has 3 children by Robert Badgerow. And suddenly she sees her life before her radically changed. And I don't know what her feelings were about Robert Badgerow. You know, she never consented to be interviewed. I think there was a, there's sometimes a feeling of hostility among, you know, from the family of the accused and the press, like, you're not giving my guy a fair shake, that sort of thing. But also the jury's reaction was really strong. It, there were a couple of women in the front row that were crying and holding hands, and there was, you know, some of the men on the jury had their heads hung and holding their face in their hands, and the defense lawyer thought, well, this shows that despite their verdict, they really don't feel good about what they've done about this verdict. And I think when this was argued the following day or the in the following days after the verdict, the judge said, you know, it was a long trial, it was a difficult trial, and just the release of this emotion and perhaps the wailing of his wife caused this reaction. And so I don't believe that there's anything here that we can, you know, invalidate this verdict because the jurors were crying.
7 years after that verdict, in 2008, Badgerow went on trial again. This time, it was for the attempted murder of Debbie Robertson, who was dragged off the street, sexually assaulted, and stabbed in the ear with a screwdriver just weeks after Diane Rowendowitz was murdered in 1981. The trial was being held in Kitchener, and the jurors were being told nothing of Badgerow's murder conviction in the death of Diane Rowendowitz.
I do have strong feelings about what happened to Debbie Robertson. I just feel that I feel for her because I think she had an unfair shake. I think that the police did not give her evidence the weight that it deserved. I mean, she said, as they were loading her into the ambulance, I know him. It's either Rick or Rob or Russell. And then they, you know, drove, took her to the hospital where she was really injured. She'd been stabbed in the side of the head and the side of the face with a screwdriver multiple times. She was in trauma. She was in shock. And then the police officers came to her room in the hospital, and she said, bring my Orchard Park High School yearbook. I know him. And then she started flipping through the yearbook, and she got to the top of page 42, and she said, that's him. And it was Rob, just as she had said.
So she identified him and handed him to the investigators.
Yes.
Really.
And what they chose to do was take the evidence of his then-girlfriend and her parents for his alibi support over her direct eyewitness evidence. And they accepted the evidence of the his girlfriend, which just doesn't seem right to me.
So you think police screwed up?
I think they did a shoddy job. And I know I'm speaking about people who are probably now deceased in terms of the investigators.
Some are. Many, yes.
Some of them are, at least. But and they can't defend themselves. And that should be taken into consideration. But that was the position of the prosecutor at the first trial, Joan Adele. He argued in hearings without the jury present that that evidence should have been accepted.
Partway through that attempted murder trial, the judge decided to stay the charges against Badgerow. Too many witnesses had died. Too much time had passed for there to be a fair trial, he ruled. So the trial was stopped, and the jury was abruptly dismissed. But before the jurors could leave the courtroom, Debbie Robertson shouted to them, Claremont remembers.
She yelled out to the jurors, you should know that he has already been convicted of killing a woman.
Meanwhile, Badgerow was appealing his murder conviction. It is standard for anyone convicted of first-degree murder to appeal their verdict. After all, with a mandatory sentence of life in prison and no chance of parole for 25 years, there is nothing to lose. But years later, it shocked many when the Ontario Court of Appeal overturned the verdict and granted Badgerow a new trial. The Crown fought it all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, but the decision stuck. On February 6, 2009, the Supreme Court upheld the order for a retrial. That day was the first time Claremont met Badgerow. She had been in the same courtroom with him before, but they had never spoken. Within hours of the Supreme Court decision, Claremont took a chance and went to visit Badgerow at the Hamilton Wentworth Detention Center. He'd been moved there from prison during the appeal process. Separated by plexiglass, they each picked up a black phone receiver and talked for the first time.
I went to the jail and got in to see him. And I think I may have actually been the person to tell him that he was going to get a second trial. I'm not certain about that. I can't remember if he'd had a chance to talk to his lawyer yet or not. But we met through glass at the jail, and I asked him for an interview, and he said, "No, I don't think I should. I think it's still before the court. I shouldn't talk to you." And he said that very politely. And he said, "But I'll tell you this. When this is all over, I will tell you the whole story." And I'd never forgotten that.
Badgerow's second trial took place in 2010, again in a Hamilton courtroom. The evidence was the same, minus a videotaped statement from Badgerow given to police an hour after his arrest. The appeal court ruled he had not been given sufficient opportunity to contact a lawyer before giving the statement. After weeks of evidence, the jurors were sent out to begin their deliberations. But in the end, they could not come to a unanimous verdict. The result was a hung jury, and a mistrial was declared. That meant there would be a third trial. This time, it was moved to a courtroom in Kitchener. By now, Barbara Brown had retired from the Spec, and so most of the paper's coverage came from columnist Susan Claremont. Remarkably, this trial also ended in a hung jury. That led Justice Gerald Taylor to make a very rare legal decision. He stayed the charges against Badgerow, saying it would be unfair and pointless to put him through another trial. So, in September 2012, Badgerow was legally declared a free man.
Diane Ware Underwood's met a violent, vicious death. Nobody deserves to die that way. I'm just not the person that was responsible for that. And it's been a roller coaster all the way from start to finish for my whole family. I admire, I respect their support of me through all this, believing in me, standing behind me.
That freedom was short-lived, however. The Crown appealed the stay, a matter that again went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. 2 years after his charges were stayed, the now infamous Binbrook resident was ordered to stand trial for a history-making fourth time. The Hamilton Spectator's city editor at the time was Carla Amaretta, who has since left the Spec for a new job. Amaretta, herself a former court reporter, knows it is impossible for the Spectator's newsroom to cover every day of every trial.
I think the Spectator has always made a commitment to court reporting and to covering justice, and especially in long-standing cases such as the Robert Badgerow one, to continue to let the people of Hamilton and area know what's going on and how they're progressing. These are cases that can take months and months to try over a number of witnesses. And not only that, but there are things that happen in between the proceedings, legal motions and the like. So it becomes a discussion then between the editor and the columnist or reporter about what are the essential elements that we need to share with the public. And not only that, but just even for our own purposes of keeping track of how cases progress. So in some instances, we'd have conversations about who is on the witness stand this day, what is the progression of the case that is going to be called, where are we in the proceedings. And there's also always the test of the fairness and balance. So it's easy to get caught up in the Crown's case because they open and they give their opening statement and they call their case first. So you're hearing all of the witnesses from the Crown's theory and perspective. You're also getting the cross-examination from the defense. But really, if and when the defense calls a case, you're really not hearing their theories in a very concrete and specific way. So we were always cognizant, and we've had these conversations many times about how much of the defense is reflected in the stories that we're telling from day to day. So it really is up to a newsroom to determine how do they best do that, knowing that they can't necessarily be there every single day for every single proceeding. And also, there are other issues, such as in the case of Badgero, we had a number of the trials that didn't occur in our own community.
The Spectator has made a special commitment to Diane's murder case. Badgero's fourth trial began in September 2016 in Kitchener. Claremont was there every day for 4 months, an enormous commitment of resources.
At the end of the testimony of the day and the proceedings, the reporter's job is never done because they still have to file their own stories. So it really does make for many, many, many long hours, lots of note-taking, and time invested for what in the end becomes what we refer to as 23 scintillating inches.
There had been a few changes in the way these trials were covered.
My trial coverage differed in a number of ways from Barb's. Some of that had to do with new technology. Barb used a notebook and pen. I used an iPad in the courtroom. At the end of the day, Barb wrote one story for the next day's paper, and I wrote an advance piece every day, did web hits throughout the day, live tweeted from the courtroom, and then wrote a column that was on the Spec's webpage after the trial ended for the day.
The implementation of new technology wasn't the only thing that was different. There was also new evidence.
When we got to the fourth trial, that jury was hearing evidence that no other jury at a Badgero trial had ever heard before. And that evidence all pertained to the phone booth. Previous juries had heard that 911 call, anonymous 911 call made a few days after Diane's murder. But no jury had heard evidence about where that call might have come from. And the fourth jury heard that the call was basically traced by police back to a phone booth right outside of Badgero's workplace at Tofasco. The trace of the phone call was incomplete because the officer who was sent to the phone booth forgot to pick up the receiver and make the connection back to the person tracing the call. So for years and for three trials, it had been thrown out as evidence. So finally, thanks to a Supreme Court decision, finally a jury was going to hear where that call likely came from. And it likely came from a phone booth just steps away from where Robert Badgero was working his shift at Tofasco.
It was December by the time the jury began its deliberations in the fourth trial, 4 months after initial proceedings. Jurors were sequestered late on a Monday morning, and it was dinner time on Thursday when word came that they had reached a verdict. Robert Glenn Badgero was found guilty of first-degree murder. Again. It surprised no one that within days of being found guilty, Badgero filed his appeal papers. It also wasn't a surprise to anyone close to the case that he applied for bail and that it was granted. He had already spent years out on bail, adhering to his conditions and staying out of trouble. Right now, Robert Badgero is living with his mother in Benbrook, awaiting word on whether he'll be given the chance to have an unprecedented fifth trial. Next time on Covering Diane.
The first time I saw the newspaper probably was a couple days later when I went to my friend's house and the newspaper was facing up, and then I walked in and then the people stopped talking, and then the newspaper was there, and then they flipped the newspaper, and then that's, you know, I knew it was, or my, I already knew it was in the paper because my dad was pretty upset about it.
Covering Diane is a serial podcast produced by David Crosby and Susan Claremont at the Hamilton Spectator.